Lee?
Got it. Wow, that's pretty cool. So yeah, that scares me. For me, it's hard for me to teach and not preach. But the first century world was a very exciting time. What do we know about the first century? What do you know about the first century? Well, Jesus was born around that time. Yeah.
The political domination of the Romans.
Yeah. Okay, the known world, and we say that with a very Western mindset, of course. You know, we're not talking about Asia, we're not talking about the Americas, we're talking about just the Mediterranean world. The known world was absolutely controlled by the Romans. What else? The fall of Jerusalem happened. That was a very significant, both political event and also spiritual event. The establishment of the new temple, the destruction of the physical temple, the establishment of
persecution.
Okay, it was a time of where persecution began. Yeah, the early persecutions began already in the first century. What else do we know about what do we know about life in the first century world? It was mostly an agricultural world, right? It was also a time where the world was becoming more and more urban. And you're going to see that. The Roman Empire was planting cities, you know. So everything of planting churches, they were establishing cities all over the place. This is what I want to talk about today. See if we can get how much of this we can get through. And again, this is a general view because you're going to get very specific when we go in that time period. And when we get into the time period, John's going to come back and talk more about what was actually happening first, second, third century. But we're going to talk a little bit about the world of the early church, the religious backdrop, the Judeo-Roman Greco society, and the culture of the early church. The culture both that it was growing in and the culture that it was itself developing, which were both very dynamic and very unique. 8 AD, I don't know if you can, I probably should have set up the little projector to be brighter. But this is the world, this is the Roman Empire in 8 AD. I don't know if you can see the outline here of the Roman Empire. It was in a time of tremendous expansion. I mean, it had been expanding for 300 or 400 years already. This is 47 AD. It's already up into Britannia. It's already taking all this. It's beginning to conquer the entire, what would be later the Black Sea. And now, by 117 AD, pretty much controls all of the, again, quote-unquote, known world. It was controlled by the Romans. Now, it's a little bit of a misnomer to say that everything was Roman, because the Roman Empire had swallowed up and then itself been very changed by what culture?
Greeks.
The Greeks. Yeah, so much of what we attribute to Roman culture is really Greek culture, Romanized. In fact, it was funny. I remember I took a class at University of San Diego, the Greco-Roman world. And the professor, the first day, he said, I'm going to spend, I think the classes are 16 weeks, he said, I'm going to spend 14 weeks on Greece and 2 weeks on the stinking Romans, all right? So if you don't like that, take another class. So it was very clear his bias about the Roman Empire, that the Roman Empire came in, took everything, renamed it, relabeled it, repackaged it, called it Roman, and then beat everybody else up with it, It was a very unique and transitional time in world history. The Roman Empire was becoming not only an empire, but an imperial organization run by a Caesar, not by a Senate, not by the Roman populace. It had swallowed Greece piece by piece, and almost like swallowing I don't want to say, it's not a negative, I would say an infection, getting an infection out of it, but something positive. It had become very Greek in its mindset, in its thinking. And it really was a synergy. It really was a mixture of two cultures. Even a lot of the Greek cities, like Corinth, that we think of, classical Greece. I mean, Corinth was a Roman colony. It had been destroyed and then rebuilt and repopulated by Romans. So even though it was a Greek city, it was populated by Romans and had Greek thinking in it. Now we know that before the Roman Empire established itself, Greece culturally had already established itself. And the common language was Greek. The standard, so to speak, much like today, we think the common language is English in terms of world business, world affairs. If you want to be somebody on a world level, you have to learn English. You have to speak English. Even though there are other languages much more widely spoken, but that is the language of power, so to speak. That's what Greek became, the lingua franca of the world. So that even in Israel, you'd have people learning Greek. Anybody who was educated, anybody who was in power, anybody who would have to learn Greek. And they would probably have to learn some Latin too to deal, you know, with any Romans who didn't speak Greek. But Greek was the language. And there's something very, very powerful about language. Language always brings a lot with it. It's not just a means of communication. It brings culture. It brings a way of thinking. It brings a way of expressing. It brings a way of presenting things. So the fact that, you know, Alexander the Great had already gone through much of where the church would grow. All of, you know, Alexander the Great from Macedonia spread all through this area. So it was already very Hellenized, which, you know, Hellenized means Greek, made Greek. Hellens were the Greeks, the Hellas. And so the world was Hellenized all through this. The Greeks had spread through the same area. So Rome, piece by piece, took over the very same area. Okay, what was the great contribution of the Roman Empire as they expanded?
The roads.
Yep. They built roads. They made highways that the army could move quickly on, that they could expand, they could do transportation, they could do trade. They solidified the world. You know, it's amazing. All of this, you see how God's looking at the entire history of the world. This is the time He picked to start the church. Which even in itself amazes me, because you think, okay, if the purpose was to get a message out, wouldn't you pick the age of communication to get the message out? But He didn't. He picked this time period. Why do you think He would have picked this time period?
The message is personal.
Okay. The message can't be
media.
It can't be spread through media. It has to be a personal message.
When the media has a subjective viewpoint.
Okay.
They it's like fed to you.
You can't ask a television any questions. There's no interaction with the radio. You know, it's a one-way thing. This message has to be communicated. It's interpersonal. It has to be shared. It has to be shown. It can't just be said, you know. It has to be demonstrated. Almost, it would be dangerous to just start the church in the age of communication, because we just put it on CNN and think the whole world got evangelized, you know. It had to go person to person. But what did happen in this time period is there was a language that everybody spoke in order to get the word out. There were roads to get to everywhere, so you could get to everywhere. And the fact that, you know, this was the middle of Pax Romana, or the Peace of Rome. Rome controlled everything. Things are quieting down right now in Tijuana. There's not so much violence. There's not so many murders. There's not so many kidnappings. Things are starting to get under control. Why? We have a new drug lord. Okay? There's a new drug lord there. So when there's a drug lord, things are at peace. When there's not a drug lord, literally all hell breaks loose and everybody's fighting and shooting and killing each other. Okay? Well, they had the great drug lord. They had the great power lord in power, Rome. And so it made the world accessible. It made the world so you could get to anywhere really very quickly. I mean, you know, at no other time period, even when the fall of Roman Empire, it was very dangerous to go from the Middle East to Italy. I mean, there were pirates, there were other nations, it was very dangerous travel. During this time period, you could jump on a boat and go from Joppa to Spain without any problem. And that was just, there are very few times in the history of the world that could happen up until recently. And again, I mean, even now, here we're in the 21st century, and ships are getting captured and pirated off the coast of Africa. You know, it's still happening. But at this time period, it was all set up. You know, God had clearly set it up. There's a language everybody speaks, and of course, What's the Bible written in? The language that everybody speaks, Greek. And it wasn't even in the scholarly Greek. It wasn't in classical Greek. It was in Koine Greek. Koine means common language, or common. Koine just means common. Koinos means common. So it was in common Greek. It would be like American English, you know. Not the British English, not the Queen's English, but it's an English that everybody speaks, everybody understands. Why everybody watches movies? So they know what it means, right? In the first century world, this was huge. There was a language that you could communicate to everybody. There were roads. There was transportation. There was security. You could actually get to places. How the world was seen was pretty much you had Israel and the Middle East. You had Africa. And at this time, Africa was very much the same as Italy, as Greece, as Asia. If you would have sailed into a port in North Africa, or in Egypt, or in Asia, or in Greece, or Italy, it pretty much looked the same. It wouldn't look very different. You'd have the Greek columns, you'd have the stone roads, you'd have the libraries, you'd have the circus, you'd have the, I don't mean like a carnival circus, I mean, you know, where the horses raced and the games were played. Pretty much anywhere. I mean, it was a Mediterranean world. You know, Augustine, the great theologian, where was he from? Which was where? Right here, Africa. He was an African. We don't think of Augustine as an African, you know. That's what he was. He was an African. The Apostle Paul, what modern day country was he from?
Spain.
Mm-mm.
Tarsus.
Tarsus, but where was Tarsus? Turkey. Paul was Turkish. You don't think of Paul as being Turkish, you know, but that's where he's from. Tarsus was in Turkey, you know, modern day Turkey. All the world was really pretty homogenized in order to be able to get everything out there and to get things moving. This is the first century Roman world. This is where you could travel, where you could go and be safe. Indeed, you know, there was a Roman garrison nearby. There was a Roman government. Greek would be the lingua franca, but it was kind of the common world. One dominating culture, one dominating society, and Israel's right in the middle of it. You know, recently they found a city about 3 miles from Nazareth, where Jesus is from. I can't remember the name of the city now. Tanis, I think, is the name of the city. No, it's not Tanis. I'll have to find the name of it. But, you know, here we picture Jesus growing up in the Middle East in a Jewish town. You know, Nazareth is basically a truck stop between Galilee and Caesarea. Caesarea was a Greek, then Roman city. A port of entry, a very high traffic trade city, Caesarea. And then you have Galilee, where, you know, it was said that at the emperor's table, fish from Galilee was served. It was a high produce. It was something that they produced and spread all over the known world. And if you went from Galilee to Caesarea, you'd stop at Nazareth. So it was basically a truck stop. You know, it's like going to Blythe or going to Yuma, Arizona. You know, that's where Jesus is from. Yuma, Arizona, you know. And yet, they find this city like 3 or 4 miles away that has a library, it has a civic center, it has all these Greek buildings and statues. And they hired all the Jews from the area to work this city. Probably Jesus worked there. Probably his dad worked there. That's probably where Joseph worked, you know. And so the Roman Greek culture, language, society was very thick. It was very much permeated the world at that time. Christianity spread. This is the first 150 years of Christianity. Look at, you know, that's the Roman world. There's the Christian world after 150 years. It just followed the same course. It was like the roads were paved for the gospel to be spread. This is the way that Christianity spread from 150 to 250. And here you've got northern Africa, Egypt, the Middle East, Israel, Turkey, Greece, the lower part of Italy, Okay, that was, you know, 100 to 150. Probably Paul, you know, it's very likely that Paul got to Spain. That was his goal before he died. 150 to 250 is where the other part, the orange, where Christianity is spreading into Spain and Gaul, which was France and Germany, into the Germanic tribes, and then of course North Africa, where this is where, again, where Augustine would be from. And then this is 400 to 600, the time period where already it's going into beyond the Black Sea into Russia. I don't know if you can see that very well. Unfortunately, it doesn't show up very well. But again, you just see it just followed the Greek and Roman world. It just followed the tracks. And that's the point. And if you can see on here, the city, the red dots are cities. This is a very urbanized world. I mean, still predominantly agricultural. But this was a time period where people were moving to cities. This is the first time this is really happening. I mean, there were always centers, you know, metropolis, some of the great cities in Egypt or the Greek cities, but that the whole world, and that's kind of what the Greco-Roman world brought, was an urban life. And that's, of course, where the church spread. I mean, we're not reading to the church in Corinthian County, you know, we're reading to the church in Corinth. And the church spread from city to city. And it was also a time of tremendous transition. I mean, Greece had been conquered by Rome, of course, and then many Romans went there because there was actually a chance for upward mobility. You could get and call. I mean, the world, you know, the trade went this route, and so Greece is right there in the middle of it. Between Asia, Middle East, the Middle East, Asia, and Europe. And so everything went through here. So this was a great place to make money, to establish a business. You know, this was the booming community, so to speak. This is the new, the expanding world where you could actually get wealthy and you could rise up. Corinth was probably predominantly people who had been poor in the Roman world who'd gone to Corinth, established businesses, established themselves, and become wealthy. They were not the classical Greek wealthy of Athens or Sparta, or they weren't that. These were people who had rose up, who had risen up in life. So it gives you a little background. For example, like when the letters to the churches in Corinth, about how they dress and how they conduct themselves. This is, you know, have you ever heard like of old money and new money?
Yes.
Old money knows how to do their money. New money tends to be flashy. Corinthians were new money people. They were the new up and coming. They were the new upward bound people who could fall easily into showing off their money. So that's where you get the thing about dressing modestly and how women come or conduct themselves in church. It was the world they were living to. It was a very prosperous time. It was a time of expansion. The one on the right is a road in Ephesus, going through downtown Ephesus. These are, on the right, these are shops. There would have been stores on the left. Like right around this corner, there's a sign that has a picture of a stick with wings and a snake going up. Can you think of what that emblem is?
Medical.
Yeah, that meant there was a doctor there. Okay. That up there was a building in Spain, in southern Spain. This was a library in Ephesus.
Well, they dressed the same back then.
Yeah, I see that. Maybe more name tags. That was the library in Ephesus. This was the small theater in Ephesus. That's Joe Field sitting there.
Yeah.
This is the small theater. I think it sat like 500-600. The big theater sat like thousands. This was this is Pergamum. I think this was Pergamum, or the main street going through Pergamum. You know, the thing about the first century world, it was very sophisticated. I mean, it had levels of society. It had the thinkers, the orators, the schools. It was very similar to ours. It's actually pretty amazing. You've seen the movie Gladiator, right? Okay, there's a lot of historical inaccuracies in here, but you get a general feel of what the world was like in these major cities. And then do you ever see the movie 13th Warrior? Okay, think of the Vikings in the Viking times. That's 1,000 years later. That's how backwards things got. This is a time where society and civilization is just thriving. Okay, and there's trade, there's music, there's the arts, there's education, there's all these things happening. The world is just expanding, and right in the middle of this, the church starts. That was that's downtown. That's Broadway in Ephesus. Okay, and at the very end of Broadway is the library right there. Which kind of show you how things were. Right across the street from the library was a brothel, and they found a tunnel that went from the library to the brothel. Can't tell you what's going on in society at the time, okay? Husbands are saying, I'm going to the library. Yeah, right. Okay, and on either side are shops, there's apartments. This is a mosaic in one of the houses. Beautiful mosaic. Beautiful mosaic. This is another mosaic. This is a street. This is outside. And it's a mosaic. It comes up to a really nice neighborhood. You know how you have these nice neighborhoods and they have beautiful gates and all these beautiful things outside. This was a mosaic entrance to a neighborhood. You know you live in a nice neighborhood when your street was mosaics. this was another street. I believe this was in Italy. Just, you know, a street, and you'd be people watching over. And that picture wasn't supposed to be there, but... But that's the general Greco-Roman world. People were very much aligned with their families. Your family was everything. Your household was everything. Dad was the leader of the family, ran the family. This was the church very much followed that pattern, would meet in households. And, you know, it was one of those scriptures that always just kind of stuck out to me, that, you know, all the members of their household were baptized. I just wondered about that. How does that work, you know? The dad gets baptized and everybody gets baptized. But that was the culture. Everybody did what dad did. And so it actually, you know, it says a lot. Again, there are many things that to understand the scriptures well, you got to kind of understand the background of what's going on. When society is centered around family, the two big structures, your family and your city. Traditional Greek society, your city is everything. If you don't have a city, you don't have it. You're homeless, basically. You have a city that you belong to. You have a family that you belong to. That's the next unit you belong to. And everything works along those lines. So your family is very significant. And the reputation your family has, what your family is known for. You know, the reputation was huge in the city and how people saw things. What are the requirements for an elder? What do you remember? What is required? Huh?
Reputation.
A good reputation with outsiders. What else?
Hospitable.
Hospitable.
What your family was like.
What your family was like.
Children
are respectful and faithful. What else?
One wife.
One wife.
Sober.
Sober-minded. Uh-huh. Not given to much drinking, right? To out of control drinking.
Had to be able to teach.
Had to be able to teach. Okay, now think about it. If you were to make a list of you're thinking, okay, who's going to lead this? And we want, think of even the church in Jerusalem. The church in Jerusalem, when they wanted somebody to wait on tables, what was the qualifications? Full of the Spirit, right? Spiritual qualifications. Spirituals, full of the Spirit, you know. It's an entirely different list. There's no spiritual qualifications for an elder.
Oh my.
Not one spiritual qualification for an elder. That list was a list that you would find in any Roman Greek city of who should be respected. It's a list of who's respected in the community. People who are sober-minded. People who are faithful to one woman. People who are not drunkards. They can control themselves. People who have a good standing in the community. You know, it's an interesting thing. There's no spiritual qualifications for an eldership. You're like, what? No. That he's a man of prayer? Didn't put that on there. That he knows the scriptures well? Didn't put that on there. Why not? Well, I think that's a given. I think it's a given. You know, you're going to lead spiritually. You've got to be a spiritual leader. But it's interesting to me, though, that that list of qualifications you can find in the same kind of list on who should be the governor of a city, who should be a general in an army. In fact, there are similar lists like that. Some of them are almost word for word. Like, for the general of this army, look for a man who is sober-minded, faithful to his family and wife. His children are respectful of him. So, whoa, whoa, this sounds like an elder. No, this is for a general in the army. But it has to be somebody who's a good leader. Somebody who's respected by the community. Okay, this is what and it tells you a lot of what people looked up to. So this is why it would be so horrifying to Paul that the church in Corinth had people getting drunk on communion. That they had sisters wearing, you know, gaudy makeup and hairdos and stuff, which was probably the style in the city, all the new money people, but not appropriate in Greek society. Not appropriate in Roman society. In Roman society, self-control was actually what was valued and respected. You say, well, yeah, but weren't Romans known for Bacchus and all that kind of stuff? They did that, but that was not respected. And the reason why everybody wanted to kill Caligula was because he was so out of control. He was not respected and looked up to. And things did go that way, and they became increasingly so. But that was not proper for a Roman. That was not proper for a Greek to let himself go like that. Self-control, moderation, good standing. These things were qualities that the world respected.
Where did they get that idea? The Romans?
Greeks. The Greeks very much believed in that. Self-control. Not giving into the flesh. You know, this is the other thing, is that the Greek mindset, which was heavily influenced by Plato. Okay, what do we know about Plato? I mean, some of you guys I know have been already in the theology class and stuff. What do we know about Plato? What did Plato teach the world? What was his contribution to Greek, to the world mindset, worldview? Okay, virtues versus vices. Everything was virtues versus vices. And understand that religion and morality were not connected in the first century world. You could be very religious and very immoral, and nobody would think twice about that. They were not connected. Now, morality and religion were not the same. The closest to that I would have to say would be, like, I grew up Catholic, and you could go out and party like crazy on Saturday night, but if you went to Mass every Sunday, you were a good Catholic.
Yeah.
Regardless of whether you partied and got drunk and slept around. But the fact that you go every Sunday, you did your first communion, your devotion to the church made you a good member of the church, regardless of how you lived your life. That's the way it was back then. That the fact that you went to temple, that you made sacrifices, you made contributions to the temple, made you a very religious person. Now, you may also be the person who hosts the orgies every Friday night, who frequents all the, you know, all the brothels, and that has nothing to do with your religion. So that was very much there. That's why, you know, again, there's so much about our purity and about our life and the example we set before others. But in terms of morality, morality was being in control, and here's where Plato had a huge influence. Platonic thinking was, you know, the all the things of the spirit world are good. The spiritual world is where good is. The physical world is where evil is. That's the Platonic duality, you know, good versus evil. That's why when the church spread into Greece, one of the issues was, could Jesus really have come in the flesh? Because the Platonic thinking is that's impossible. The flesh is evil. All evil comes from the flesh. Spirituality is good. There's no way Jesus could have come in the flesh. So that's where you get this, you know, the Arianism and the different teachings that taught that Jesus couldn't have been in the flesh, that he had to only have been in the spirit. Or that if he came in the flesh, he couldn't have been God. Because there's no way that God could come in the flesh. And that teaching is still being taught today. You know, I mean, that's still...
Gnosticism
comes from out of that teaching. That whole Platonic worldview of all the things of the Spirit. And basically, in the Greek or Roman Greco mindset, as we live in the physical world, which is a shadow of the spiritual world, and the spiritual world is good, and our problem is we all have to break out of the physical world and get to the spiritual world. where everything is good. But we're trapped by this physical world. So now you think about that and think, well, you can think of a lot of correlations in what Paul says, right? In Paul's teachings, and especially in Corinth. And some of the things Paul says, he purposely encases it in a way that anybody in the Roman Greco world would understand. You know, flesh, you don't give in to your flesh. You are worldly. I mean, how many times in 1 Corinthians Paul talks about them being worldly, or literally it's of the flesh. You are sarxis. You are of the flesh. You are not of the spirit. You know, you're not being of the spirit. Part of that was just everybody understood that. I mean, part of that obviously is it's true. I mean, the God, things of God are true. Now, what is not true is it's not just light and darkness, evil and good. It's not yin and yang. Yin and yang is that the world is in a struggle between light and darkness. The problem, what's the problem with yin and yang? Why is that not Christian? What's the problem with every? Or maybe we're thinking, I thought that was the way it was.
I think it's what, I was thinking that, you know, you look at the Jewish scriptures, the Old Testament, and it says God created the world that was good. It was very good.
Yeah.
And the Greeks and the Romans would have thought, well, how can the world be good? It's material. It's evil.
Right.
So the whole idea of the way you behave in this world and the way you act and what you touch and who you, you know, associate with can be good, you know. Versus the Greek speaking of that, you know, conceivably eating is evil. You know, if you can abstain from eating, you would do a good thing, you know.
Yeah. Okay, there's the first huge problem is that God created the physical world and said it is good. Okay, there's a theological foundation right there that completely contradicts the Roman Greco mindset. That natural or physical things are not inherently evil. They're actually good. Okay, what else would be the problem with that? With the whole yin-yang or Platonic thinking?
At least it's a symbol. Evil is equally as strong as good, and so there's
okay. Yeah, and in fact, people even take it a step farther and say it's a balance. You know, you're supposed to balance the two. You know, even in you know, I mean, I love Star Wars and everything, but they're always looking for this balance between the light and darkness. No, darkness is supposed to be wiped out. God is light and God is good. Darkness is not good. I don't want a balance of good and evil. I want good to win. I want evil to be destroyed and wiped out. So, no, we're not striving for a balance. And that is Platonic thinking, that there's a balance. There's a balance of good and evil, and that, you know, there's always evil, there's always good, and you work with the two, and neither one should overpower the other. That's more yin and yang, but definitely in the Platonic thinking, that's everything was in that struggle and in that balance. And that is not Christian. I mean, being worldly, being fleshly, and I think that Paul used that terminology because they understood it. You know, just like if you were teaching, you know, a bunch of Native Americans or natives from some other country, and they had the mindset of a great spirit, you might use that mindset to help them understand God, and say, let me tell you who the great spirit is. You still use the word great spirit, not that you're endorsing their religion, but that you're encasing it in a way that they can understand, in a paradigm that's understandable to them. Paul used a lot of that, which makes you, you know, which also just kind of shows you God's brilliance and who he converts and who he sends where. Because Paul was, first of all, a Pharisee, a son of a Pharisee. He was not born in Israel, so he's born in where? What country?
Turkey.
Yeah, he was born in Turkey, you know, which was Asia Minor back then. Galatia, you know, and so he, which is the crossroads between the Roman Greco world and the Middle East. So Paul was very much just a very international person. He spoke, his sermon at the Areopagus was brilliant. It was brilliant. He's not quoting Moses. He's not quoting anything out of the Old Testament. He's speaking Greek. He's quoting Greek poets, you know. And he's totally the fusion guy there, you know, connecting to them and using terminology that they understand. The God who created the heavens and the earth, and of course they didn't like the resurrection part. Again, you're talking about the physical being good. That doesn't make any sense to them, but. But he encased it all in a way they could understand. He represented in many ways the next generation of Christians. of being able to reach out, which is one of the reasons why I feel very excited about this topic and about the first century world, because I feel like there's a lot of great lessons. And in fact, if anything, God kind of closed the door with Israel with the fall of Jerusalem. I mean, that just, he just kind of closed it down. The book of Hebrews says, it's over, it's done, don't look back. And then within 2 or 3 years, Jerusalem gets wiped out. The temple gets torn apart. And it was exactly what the book of Hebrews said was going to happen. This, you know, you Christians, because what did the Christians want to do? They wanted to look back. Remember the Judaizers, and that's what the book of Hebrews is all about, is the Christians not shrinking back into the Jewish world. And even in the, you know, here they are all the way out to Rome. They're spreading all over the known world, and they're reaching, it's like they're reaching back to Jerusalem to find their roots, to find their foundation. So what does God do? He says, well, I'll just erase Jerusalem. Now you can't reach back there. There's no going back. There's no looking back. There's just looking forward. You know, and you are the light into this world. Not, you're not restoring Jerusalem. You're not restoring Israel. But you see, but so God basically just closed that down. And there was no looking back. This, you know, during the first century, as the church is expanding, it presented a lot of challenges to the church. You know, you think about it, okay, what was probably, you know, what percentage do you think of the church in Jerusalem was Jewish?
100.
Yeah, maybe 99.9, a few converts. And, you know, we all know it took them a long time to get out of Israel. Okay, when Jesus sent them out, and, you know, the Great Commission, he said, Ponsa ta ethnos, go into all the foreigners. It was very clear, ethnos, every Jew knows, those are the foreigners, those are the Gentiles. He said very clearly, go to the Gentiles and make disciples. They didn't want to do it. They didn't do it in Acts 2, they didn't do it in Acts 3, they didn't do it in Acts 4, they didn't do it in 5 or 6 or 7. It wasn't until chapter 8 that they even got pushed out of there. And remember in Acts chapter 1, he said, Jerusalem, Judea, Samaria, and to the ends of the earth, right? That was, he gave them the plan. They didn't want to do it. So it wasn't until Acts chapter 8, they get pushed out into Samaria. And then they go as far north as Tyre and Sidon. And even then, it just stops there. And even in Acts chapter 8, it says everybody went except who? The apostles. The apostles stayed in Jerusalem. They didn't do what he said, you know? And it was pretty clear what he said to do. Go to all the foreigners. And they didn't do it. And then, of course, then Jesus, you know, gives Peter a vision of, you know, not to call things unclean. Because why? Because how can you reach out to people if you won't touch them and you won't go into their house?
Right.
You know, they were, in their mind, Gentiles, they're unclean. So God gives Peter the vision, stop calling things unclean. He sends him to Cornelius' house, who's a Gentile. And so he goes to Cornelius' house, you know, for the first time. And then Peter's all, whoa, look at these Gentiles. They're all getting the Holy Spirit. What's going on here? They're amazed. I mean, he'd already made it very clear. And in fact, in Peter's own sermon, he said, in the last days I will pour out my Spirit on who? All peoples. Both Jews and Gentiles. He says, your men and women. Not just, yeah, there you go again. That blew their minds. Because they were, you know, they didn't, you know, the old Pharisee prayer. Thank God that I'm not a, what does it say? I'm not a Gentile, a woman, or a dog. You know, I mean, which tells you what their mindset was. And they didn't get it. I mean, Peter even quoted it. But he didn't even get it. You know, that what he was saying was so powerful that the Spirit would be poured on all peoples, that all peoples would preach and prophesy. I mean, God was, not only did he provide the language, pave the roads, he put up signs saying, go this way, you know. And they still didn't go. You know, they still didn't go.
It kind of makes me think about how grounded the Old Testament is in whole concept of nation state, you know, like, okay, God's people are going to be of this one nation.
Yeah.
Everybody needs to believe this one faith, and how God was trying to break that mold and saying, no, God's people can be of any nation.
Yeah.
And, which is exciting, because it helps you see that God is doesn't care, you know, what nation you're from or what background you come from.
Yeah. It was, it shows you how it is so much our nature to think small and to keep it, I guess in a sense, in a range that we can control it.
Right.
What the vision he gave them was so much bigger. And what the calling was so much bigger. And in the first century world, everything was ready. Everything was prepared. The ability to travel, the ability to just even get down a road, to the language, the culture, everything was made ready for the church to expand across the world. That was, you can't see it, it's a painting of the fall of Jerusalem and just how destructive that was. Yes. Yeah, I'm careful to say anything is specifically set up by him, but clearly he allowed it, and the timing was right. I mean, it was like he shut down Judaism as it was known. You know, he just shut it down. Now, obviously, Judaism survived, and it morphed and changed and adapted, but it was like it had served its purpose, it was done. It had launched the church, so he closed it down. Now, it snuck out and survived and kept going in a different form and into becoming modern Judaism, but it was like God shut it down. In fact, when we were running around in Jerusalem, our guide, who was Jewish, said that one of the most bizarre things he said was in AD, I don't remember the exact year, but it was right around the time of the fall. When the city of Jerusalem fell, the Gihon Spring, which is the water that is provided to Jerusalem, it's where the water comes from, he said it became bitter and poisonous. And for a long time, many of the Essenes or later Hasidic Jews said you cannot rebuild the temple because it is that mound, the mound of Mount Moriah, where the temple was built, is cursed by God because of what happened, because of the spring going bitter. And it was like, it's almost like God said, I'm not even going to let you live there. You know, I mean, it's like, you're out of there. You're completely out of there. And so, yeah, a lot of very bizarre things happened that just shut it all down. Like, that's it. This is over. And the world, you know, I mean, you think about the challenge the church had going from a Jewish church. You know, of course, you got all the backdrops. You've got the Pharisees who, you know, kind of get a little bit of a bad rap out of the New Testament. I mean, they were the bad guys in the issues with Jesus, but they started out as a purity movement. They started out as a back to God movement. You know, in the time when the Greeks were basically running the known world, and the time of the Maccabees, you know, there were Jews, many Jews were beginning to dress like Greeks. They were adopting Greek culture. They were leaving Jewish culture. And so there was a movement to get back to God, to be faithful to the scriptures, you know, because there were Jews that were shaving. You know, this was one of the big distinctions. In fact, in a lot of the early, I think of the early picture I showed, the early pictures of Jesus, that's Jesus in the middle. All nice and clean shaven, short haircut, looking very Greek, looking very Roman, you know. And what was happening in like two, this was a couple hundred years before Jesus, but Jews were shaving and cutting their hair and dressing like Greeks, and there was a movement to get back to being Jews, being God's people. And so this was the Pharisees. They started this. We get back to God, back to being loyal to God. Well, like many movements, they got overly zealous in the wrong areas. They got legalistic, you know. And I mean, it's something we could never relate to, but you know, it's what they went through. So they got overzealous. And then, of course, you had the Essenes who were, you know, they were the guys that wanted to go up in the mountains and find Jesus in nature, and they were the Jewish version, find God in the desert. You had the Herodians who were working with Herod. You had the Sadducees who were the wealthier families. They had their ties back to the Levites. So they claimed kind of the Jewish aristocracy, but they were also, you know, they also worked with the Romans and the Greeks, and they adopted a lot from them. So the Pharisees really didn't like the Sadducees, Israel was pretty much a mess when Christianity showed up, when Jesus showed up and started his movement. But that was, you know, I mean, this is what was going on, and so the early church is mostly Jewish. and it spreads into the Greco-Roman world. To me, probably one of the most fascinating events is, you know, around AD 50, the Emperor Claudius kicks all the Jews out of Rome, right? And that's when Priscilla and Aquila get kicked out, and they come and they join Paul. And so he kicks out all the Jews. Now, the church in Rome was probably, I don't know, 90% Jewish. So imagine, you know, if everybody got kicked out of San Diego except Filipinos. They're the only ones that are allowed to stay. So the rest of us, the Mexicans, the Caucasians, and everybody African American, everybody else gets thrown, Irish, everybody gets thrown out. So we're out for 5 years. 5 years later, we're allowed to come back. Well, guess what? You know, when everybody got kicked out, there was only about 150 Filipinos. So now we come back, the church has 5,000 members, 5,000 Filipinos. The service is in Tagalog now. The food, you know, communion is
rice
now. They're serving lumpias, you know, and they're and everybody's like, okay, but can I do this instead? And there's a cultural clash. I mean, you imagine the Jews come back to Rome. It's now a completely Gentile church, and they're having pork at the agape feast.
Wow.
The Jews are struggling. You know, what are you doing? You know, and this happened all across the Roman Empire. I mean, it particularly happened in Rome because they got kicked out of Rome. But the culture is having to learn to be one, having to learn to love one another, having to learn not to squabble over trivial things, having to learn to when do you just bite your tongue and not say anything? When do you stand up for something and say this is wrong? You know, and how to balance that out. And that's what, you know, Paul devotes quite a few chapters in the book of Romans to that. Of what do you just look the other way? What do you stand up and fight for? And again, always the overriding call is for the church to love each other. And so they had to form, in many ways, their own culture. The Christian culture. By AD 50, you know, they got kicked out of Rome because the emperor said that some guy named Crestus is causing problems. Well, what does Crestus sound like?
Jesus.
Yeah, like Christos. This is how you say his name in Latin. So probably it was the Christians who were causing the problems and got the Jews kicked out, you know, out of Rome. So they weren't real happy about all the problems the Christians were causing. So by that time, the Jews were distancing themselves from the Christians. They were saying, okay, we might believe in the same God, but you guys are troublemakers. You need to have your own services. You know, you go start your own churches because you're not welcome at the synagogue anymore. You guys are bringing down trouble on us. And so by that time, the Jews are completely pulling away. And that's, and then persecution is starting to heat up with the Christians. And then that's why you have to have a letter like the letter to Hebrews saying, because, you know, some Roman official comes knocking on your door and says, are you a Jew or are you a Christian? And well, you're Jewish, but you're a Christian. So what do you say? If you say you're Jewish, they'll move on. If you say you're a Christian, they're going to tell you to pack up and leave today. So some of the Christians were struggling, and they were saying, no, I'm Jewish. I'm Jewish. And that was the whole struggle. They were trying to hide, blend back in.
So the question to me becomes, I'm sure this happened in different places, but synagogue at what time did the Christians say, okay, we're going to not, or maybe they just never did say we're not going to go to synagogue because they weren't Jewish and Christianity was one and the same for them at that point. But obviously the Greeks were not going to synagogue because they weren't Jewish.
Well, that was the big issue, and that's why, you know, right, I mean, the first conflict in the church was over Grecian Jews and widows, Grecian widows and Jewish widows, right? The next big conflict was over what?
What traditions to hang on to.
Yeah, Acts 16, right? Acts 15 and 16. Do these Greek Jews, Christians, have to become Jews? Do they need to get circumcised? Do they need to go to synagogue? Do they need to obey the laws of, you know, kosher? Do they need to celebrate? Do they need to hold all the commandments? That was the first big issue, exactly what you're saying. Because, like, okay, it's no big deal when you've only got a couple of Gentiles at church. You know, you got 200 Jews. But now you got 200 Gentiles, you know. Now what do you do with these people? They didn't come to synagogue Saturday. Are they struggling? Are they in sin? You know, how do we deal with this? There was no uniform dealing. You know, there was no uniform thought. Now, the obvious biggest spokesman at that time period was Paul. And we don't have a whole lot of what any of the other apostles thought about this. Paul definitely does. Acts, Luke, I guess you could have, you know, through Acts we get Luke's, you know, recording of what was said and done. But you have this issue in all of them. I mean, in Corinth, you have this huge issue. They're divided. You know, that's why the whole chapter 12 about one body, chapter 13 about love, what love is, about being united. Galatians, you have the Judaizers, you know, and bringing the whole church to another level of legalism. But that was all based on the law because they were Jews. This is the issue in Galatian churches, which is very close to Israel. In Rome, you had this issue when they came back. So this problem was just going through all the churches. Like, we think sometimes that we're, you know, we're going through all this stuff, the church went through all these changes. Boy, this was all the time. This was normal life back then. These big issues that come up, how do you deal with them? And they require an understanding of the culture, of the society, of what's going on. You know, I mean, I understand. I took a whole class just on 1st and 2nd Corinthians, and now I understand a whole lot of things way better than I ever have in my life, you know? Which, before, there's a lot of areas like, why did he say that? Or why did he do that? Well, now I understand, okay, what's going on with the women? What's going on with the men? What's going on with the new upward-bound society in Corinth, and be people being flashy with their money, and this whole competitive thing of, you know, I speak in tongues, I can prophesy, and Paul just telling them to all shut up and, you know, worship God, you know, and when you understand all that, it's like, okay, now that makes sense. Those issues were not the same issues in the church in Jerusalem, but unity was. I mean, unity is basically been a huge issue since day one. You know.
It's interesting that Acts, they talk about stay out of sexual immorality, which obviously is a command from God, not a command from Christ, right? Then the next one they mention is, I don't remember off the top of my head, but the thing that really sticks out to me is don't eat blood.
Yeah.
And I thought, well, why would they tell this to the Gentiles? Because, and I think about, that's more offensive to the Jews. The Gentiles could care less.
Right, know? Right.
So it's almost like they're saying, in order for us not to create too many problems in the church, please don't bring blood to the
right. Meat. Don't bring meat with blood in it. Yeah. Yeah. Which I think gives us a great overriding principle. Now, for some people, people who are biblicists that want, you know, if the scripture says it, you have to do it exactly like that. And don't take it in context, background, what's the meaning. He clearly said, no meat. No meat sacrificed to idols. What does Paul say in Romans? 30 years later. Or 20 years later. So don't worry about it. If it causes your brother struggle, don't do it. If nobody knows, don't say anything. It's kind of a don't say, don't touch kind of policy. You know, it's like, just don't say anything, all right? If nobody asks what kind of meat it is, don't offer them, you know? Don't tell them what kind it is or where you got it, you know? It's a very different teaching. But again, that's where you got to understand the background, the culture, and why. Well, did God flip-flop on this? No, because nobody ever said that this is what God wants for all time. It's definitely, I mean, if you're in the church in Jerusalem, don't you dare bring food that's unkosher, you know, bring what's kosher. But if you're in the church in Rome and nobody's asking, don't worry about it. You know, and the guiding principle is what is best for the body? What is best for the gospel? That's the guiding principle. And this is a paper I didn't get to write. I wanted to write how the one common teaching I see in all of Paul's letters and John's is what is best for the body and what is best for the gospel. Everything they say lines up to that. And that's why even sometimes you'll see something that Peter says, something that Paul says, and they don't line up right. But if you look at the context, they both line up perfectly parallel. Whoa. What is best for the gospel? And those are the chairs that slid down. They slid all the way down. So,
Paul,
and I said, dead. No, God, that was God's exclamation mark. See, what is best for the body and what is best for the gospel? That's your guiding, governing principle for the church and dealing with all these cultural issues. And again, this is why, again, goes back to why is it important to understand the first century? Because, one, the first century world is very similar to us. What was the rising thing? The rising thing in the first century? Entertainment. It was booming. The circuses, the gladiator fights, the world was becoming very focused on pleasure and entertainment. And this is the world the church is interjected in, and everything that Paul, Peter, John, the apostles taught. And why is that so important? Well, what they're doing is they're taking Jesus' teachings and applying them to a modern situation. And those principles they use are very good for us to guide us in how we apply. Well, do we make a law that if you know everybody sees a rated R movie is in sin and shouldn't take communion? I would do that, but we do need to guard our purity, and we do need to be careful about what movies we're seeing and what we're allowing to influence us. You know,
all the theaters were done in the nude, right? So
what's that?
All the theaters, all the Roman theaters, all the Greco-Roman shows were done in the nude. Right.
Yeah. Yep. And so were all the games, all the athletic games were all in the nude. And you know, it's like, okay, well, that's not going to be a family event. I can tell you that. You know, and you know, we can say, well, yeah, those were bloody. Those gladiator fights. People killed each other. Okay, how different is that from watching that on a screen? You know, and I don't know. You know, it's and I'm not giving the answer on that. I'm just saying that the principles still apply. And there are so many situations that they faced at that time. The decay of the family, the rise in divorce rate, the rise in immorality. We hear all about the debauchery of the Roman Empire.
Homosexuality,
the rise of homosexuality, the acceptance and standardization of homosexuality, that it was, you know, and that actually started even before, but was, you know, all of these things were becoming such major issues in society that the church had to deal with and had to face and challenge and what it meant to be set apart, what it meant to be a holy people who were in the world but not of the world. And that was their struggle. And that's why, you know, I mean, that's why I love, you know, learning about this time period, because it's very similar. And I think personally, just looking at all the time periods in history, there's no other time period that's more similar to ours. That's why I think this is something that happened in our time period. I don't know what, but it's so close to that time period. Yeah, I mean, the known world became a community. Our globe has become a community. You know, I mean, we know if there's a disaster in Southeast India, we know it as fast as people in Northwest India do. Maybe even faster, you know. And here we are on the other side of the globe. And that's what was happening in the first century world. That what happened in one place affected the entire known world. And it was all kind of connected, which was great for spreading the gospel. It was great for getting the word out. We're in that time period again, where it's all becoming one period, one globe community, and what happens in one place affects everybody else. So a sister asked me one time, she said, do you think, you know, the Bible says that everybody's going to see Jesus return. Do you think that God's going to flatten the earth so that we can all see Jesus? I said, you know, he might just come out on CNN and everybody will see it, you know. I mean, the entire globe would see it, you know. Between Fox News, MSNBC, and CNN, everybody would see it.
I don't think so.
I don't think so, and I answer quickly only because I've kind of looked for what specialized ministries were in the Bible. There were no singles ministries or campus ministries or Mary's ministry. It was just the ministry. Now, that's not to say that they can't happen, because there was a specialized ministry in Jerusalem for the Grecian widows. So I think, again, there's that principle, what's best for the body, you know, and that's why I'm okay with the Spanish ministry. It's not because I think it's okay to separate any group, but it's a language issue, and the gospel will get spread faster in that language for that group of people. The rest of us, it doesn't matter what color we are, we all speak English, we can all be together. We can all be one group. I have not run into any situations where it creates a conflict between ministries. I do think there are times where one ministry might have to suffer a little for the benefit of another ministry. But again, as long as the overall guiding is what's best for the body, then we're okay. You know, obviously, like, for example, campus ministry, you know, how much contribution do they give? Well, probably not even enough to buy us dinner. You know, I mean, it's just not that much. And yet, we do put a lot of time and energy into them. Why? Well, because they're what's best for the body, because that's building our future. That's our future. I mean, look how encouraged the church was by the campus service last week. You know, so, well, who's paying for that then, for them to get all that help? Well, really, the marrieds are. Okay, but that it's not to penalize the marrieds, but it's just wise for the body. What's happening in most churches right now in America, their aging membership, the church is dying. It's disappearing. And they're not able to reach the next generation. We've learned how to do that, so we're doing it. Who's paying for that? The older members. But is that wise? Absolutely wise. And you think about, okay, how old were the apostles when they were reached out to? Most likely they were all teenagers. Probably 15, 16, 17, around that age. They were men, but they were very young men. And, you know, that was Jesus' strategy. Because, I mean, just the fact that John could live to around 80, 90, 92.
Back in those days.
Man, he had to be like 14, 15 years old when he was called. He had to be very young when he was called to follow Jesus. So we're doing the same thing. That's one ministry sacrificing for another. But again, it's for the overall good of the body.
Amen.
Wow, that's good.
I was just thinking, she said that. We were actually talking about this on the way down here, that there was no concept of specialized ministries because, you know, that's more of a modern day mindset. You have your campus and you have, you know, every
yeah.
It was just about people, you know. There probably weren't, you know, a group of universities. Although there were schools of thoughts and philosophers that took students, you know, it wasn't like you had this vast group of people who were all getting student loans and going to school. You know?
Right.
That's kind of just a I don't know, modern mindset. And I think sometimes in studying church history and studying culture, you realize, you know, a lot of our thinking is so steeped in our own culture and our own experience that we lose sight of what's actually happening in the Bible. You know, it's just mouth to mouth. I love you. I share the gospel with you. You know, there weren't mission schools like there are
right.
You know? So, you know, I think the gospel just spread because the disciples were living the life.
Yeah, definitely. Okay. A couple more questions and we'll wrap it up.
What you just said, that it kind of makes sense to me because, you know, I teach teenagers.
Uh-huh.
And when these disciples, you know how the gospel says, come first, and they all...
Yeah, who's the greatest? And
who's the greatest? So, you know, so it kind of makes sense to me.
Right.
My teenagers are, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, people in their 30s, they know better than to ask a stupid question like that, you know? But people, teens, they ask stupid questions like that, you know? They just, you know, who do you think's fastest of us, you know? It's like, who cares, you know? It's like, but that's very big on their mind, you know? Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And you even think about, I mean, I think about the incredible, the radical faith that it took. You know, the older you get, you know, you're more cautious. You've burned your hand enough times to know not to just grab the pot, you know. And but that can also be a block to having faith. And, I mean, they just followed. And they just went out. I mean, this is the kind of stuff that I see it in the teens in the campus. They're just, they have that faith that, I mean, if we bought them all tickets next week to go to Africa and start a church, they'd do it. They'd do it. That's their faith, you know. That's why you got to have elders and you got to have people with wisdom to guide them. But they have that faith that you see the apostles, you know, practice. So it's definitely. Any other questions on the first century world?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, that's a good... I just brought some trinkets and stuff that just kind of give you a feel. This is a lamp I bought in Jerusalem. It's not an original first century lamp, but this is what they were made like. And you find, the amazing thing, yeah, I still use them. And they're sold everywhere. They probably don't cost much to make, and they sell for nothing. You just put a little oil in there and you light it, and it works. And these are the lamps that they used. So you understand when Jesus said, "Don't light a lamp, put a bowl over it." You know, that makes perfect sense. It was like $3. Yeah. And I'm sure I probably paid double, you know, being a tourist.
You were a tourist, like.
Yeah, I was actually in the Arab quarter, but they probably buy them for 50 cents or something, you know. This is a coin this is a real first century coin. This is the little copper coins that Jesus talked about with the widow's mite. This is a real one from the first century. They're not real well done. You know, the stamp's crooked, but you could see the stamp. Of course, coins were a big issue because you couldn't have, the Jews would not use anything with a human figure or an animal figure. Still don't. So that's why they had to be traded at the temple. Because you see the Roman coins, I mean, everybody's face, so these are Greek, these are Roman. Everybody's, won their head all over it.
Are they reproductions?
These are reproductions. This one's real. This stone, I actually was standing in the courtyard of where the trials happened of in Caesarea Philippi. If you remember, Paul was brought to Caesarea Philippi. He was questioned by Felix and Pontius. Pontius. Who was?
Agrippa.
Yeah. It was just, the courtyard was just a pile of rubble. This was, you can see the polished marble. This was actually, Paul stood here. This was actually from the courtyard where Paul was.
Part of the tomb of Paul.
Yes, part of Paul's tomb. And then I have this, where is it? That burnt rock. I was actually up on Mount Carmel. And see, this little rock was, it's all burned up. It's not where Elijah stood, but But I got to find a rock that looks like it was burnt. I have a couple of them actually. And these are seashells from Galilee, and right on the beach in Capernaum. Just grabbed a hand. I didn't have any money for anything, so I just grabbed rocks and stuff. And then actually one of the brothers threatened to turn me into the Ministry of Archaeology for this. And I said, "It's a rock." He said, "No, it's a polished marble." Okay, I'm sorry. So I apologize for that one. But and these, actually, it's amazing because, okay, these are all pot shards. These are just pieces of pots. And the guide's looking at them, and of course guides lie a lot, so you always have to be careful. But we were in Megiddo, which goes back hundreds of years. Megiddo is in the valley of it's Harmageddon, which Armageddon, the final battle. Megiddo sits on a little hill, and it overlooks all that. And it's really wild because you can stand on Megiddo, and right to here is the Carmel Mountains. This is where Elijah, called down fire from heaven. Right across is the hillside next to Galilee, or Nazareth, where probably Jesus went up. It's the only hill, so it's probably where they wanted to throw him off. It's probably where he went up to pray all the time. Right below is the valley where Gideon, had his men drink water and everything. And then right in the middle is Harmageddon, or the Armageddon, the valley where the big battle is. That's a highway. It's a highway intersection. One heads off to Asia, China. One heads off down to Egypt, and the other one heads up north to Europe. So this is a huge, this is where three continents connect, basically. And this is right in the heart of Israel, So this is a pretty intense place. So you had everything. You had Egyptians, you had Greeks, you had Romans, you had, of course the Jews, you had everybody just going right there. I mean, it was like in a first century version of New York, or a truck stop right outside of New York City, where just everybody was heading off to some major place, probably like an airport, But and this, of course, is a Roman sword, two-sided replica, not a real one, in a Roman helmet. But it just kind of gives you a feel of what the world was really a lot like our world. You know, very sophisticated societies, trade, business, you know, life was booming. Very different from 1,000 years later when, you know, the known world at that time, of European at least, and North African, all fell into the Dark Ages. And now the Middle East thrived because of Islam. And Islam, you know, it became the glory, the golden era of Islam. And where study and universities and cities and everything were thriving, while Europe and North Africa and Asia were Asia Minor were in their dark ages, and you had, you know, barbarians running around burning everything and tearing everything up. But for that time period, which I believe is very much like ours, it was a time of much transition, a lot of progress. Society was kind of unraveling. You know, the fall of the family structure and morality and all that was just getting way out of control. So, that's the class. We'll stop there.
So, what's the one coming up in 8 weeks?
Jan, do you know the syllabus? What's next week? I think it's well, just logically, it'll be the first 300 years of the church.
Are we going to get the prescription then, or?
Yes. Yeah, that'll. That's next Saturday.
Well,
actually, it's the one after that, because this coming one is the Women's Day, right? I think we take a break. Yeah, the Women's Day is a break. There's no class that Saturday. So 2 weeks from now will be the first 300 years of the church. Is he on there?
We're not going to meet.
So we're not meeting next week?
Well, that's what John and I had discussed. Jan, do you know if he changed his mind and decided to go ahead and have a class that week?
Yeah, I guess it's 24.
You know what? What time is the Women's Day? Maybe it's later.
10.
It's at 10?
Women's Day is at 10.
Oh, no, I know what it was. We were trying to get it all done before Thanksgiving.
Yeah.
So we thought we'll just go ahead and do it, and so either people can go later to Women's Day or they can just get the tape, either way.
I think the only time we skip is the marriage.
Yeah, you're right, you're right, you're right.
Okay, so we are
going to be here next Saturday, 9 o'clock.
Okay, so.
And John, I believe, is doing the first 300 years of the church. Right over there.
By the way, John is.
Yeah.
Yeah.